listening to The Corbett Report.
Welcome back, friends. Welcome back to The Corbett Report. I'm James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, coming to you, as always, from the sunny climes of Western Japan here in July of 2024, with episode 463 of The Corbett Report podcast, The Gaza Holocaust. Now, you may be forgiven for not realizing or not seeing, in recent days, this landmark ruling coming down from the International Court of Justice. But here it is, even from the Times of Israel, no less. World Court, Israeli presence in East Jerusalem, West Bank, is illegal and must end. Which notes that, in a conclusive and unambiguous decision, the International Court of Justice declared in a non-binding ruling Friday that Israel's 56-year-long rule in the Palestinian territory occupied since 1967 is illegal, and that it is obligated to bring its presence in that territory to an end as rapidly as possible. In its decision, the ICJ said it determined Israel's policy of settlement in the West Bank violates international law, and that Israel had effectively annexed large parts of the West Bank, along with East Jerusalem, which was formally annexed in 1980, due to some of the apparently permanent aspects of Israeli rule there. The legal consequences of its findings, the court ruled, were that Israel must end its control of these areas, cease new settlement activity, repeal all legislation and measures creating or maintaining the unlawful situation, including those which it said discriminate against the Palestinian people in the occupied Palestinian territory, and provide reparations for any damage caused by its wrongful acts. It then goes on to talk in more detail about this occupation and the form that it has taken over the years, and why it is illegal. But this is, of course, a pretty important ruling, although it must be noted, of course, a non-binding ruling. So it has no real legal teeth to it, but it certainly does reflect an interesting opinion that is increasingly part of the international community. So what is the U.S. government's response to this? Well, exactly as you might expect, U.S. criticizes ICJ ruling that Israeli occupation of Palestine is illegal. The U.S. has criticized the International Court of Justice's ruling that said the Israeli occupation of Palestinian territories is illegal and must come to an end, claiming it impedes a two-state solution. We are concerned that the breadth of the court's opinion will complicate efforts to resolve this conflict and bring about an urgently needed, just and lasting peace, with two states living side by side in peace and security, a State Department spokesperson told Reuters in an email on Saturday. The spokesperson said that the ICJ ruling, which was a non-binding opinion, was inconsistent with the established framework. Well, I'll let you opine for yourself on whether you think that the Pentagon and the State Department and Uncle Sam generally is or has ever been concerned with a just and lasting peace or peace and security in the Middle East, let alone anywhere else in the world, but that's their story and they're sticking to it. Now, as I say, you're forgiven for not having seen this story even, because as we sit here in July of 2024, nearly 10 months into this war conflict, well, we'll come to the nomenclature that's used to describe what's happening in Gaza right now. It seems that nobody is that interested in this story anymore. That's old news. No, the world's attention is now focused on the U.S. presidential selection process that will determine nothing, will change nothing, will certainly not move U.S. foreign policy from its staunch position of supporting Israel no matter what it does one iota. But meanwhile, in Gaza, torn up bodies. Israel intensifies bombing campaign in Gaza, which notes that the Israeli military has continued its relentless bombardment of Gaza, with strikes hitting the southern, central, and northern parts of the territory. The Palestinian Civil Defense said on Saturday that its crews retrieved the bodies of 12 people who were killed in separate Israeli attacks on the Nusayret refugee camp in central Gaza. The Israeli army had bombed a residential tower in the area. No word yet on it whether there are any comic book renderings of whatever terrorist lair headquarters may or may not have resided under that residential tower in the refugee camp. But this article goes on to talk about other attacks in other places around Gaza that, yes, are still continuing and continuing to kill civilians, men, women, and children on a daily basis, to the point where there are now nearly 40,000 deaths in the past 10 months. And as we have seen recently, as was reported on New World Next Week, The Lancet has predicted as many as 186,000 excess deaths to result from the fighting that has taken place so far, even if it was to end tomorrow, which, of course, there is no sign that it will. So, business as usual, you might say, if you've been keeping your eye on any of the conflicts that have been taking place in the Middle East throughout our lifetime. Yes, but something is different this time around. Something about this particular slaughter is so indefensible, so brazen, so on its face, a blatant violation of the most blatant standards of human decency, that not even the bought and paid for prostitutes of the establishment mouthpiece media can any more hide their shock and disgust at the brazen lies coming from Israel, the Israeli government, and its spokespeople.
But you know that there are a lot of refugees, a lot of innocent civilians, men, women, and children in that refugee camp as well, right?
This is the tragedy of war, Wolf. I mean, we, as you know, we've been saying for days, move south. Civilians that are not involved with Hamas, please move south.
I'm just trying to get a little bit more information. You knew there were civilians there. You knew there were refugees, all sorts of refugees, but you decided to still drop a bomb on that refugee camp attempting to kill the Hamas commander. By the way, was he killed?
I can't confirm yet. There'll be more updated. Yes, we know that he was killed. About the civilians there, we're doing everything we can to minimize. I'll say it again. Sadly, they are hiding themselves within civilian population. And again, we are doing this stage by stage, and we're going to go after every one of these terrorists who was involved in that heinous attack on the 7th of October.
More journalists have been killed in 3 months of Israel's war on Gaza than all of, according to the Committee to Protect Journalists, more of all of World War II or the Vietnam War. Compare it to the Ukrainian War, which has obviously been going on for longer. 15 journalists were killed in the whole of 2022. Whether they're journalists or not, the fact that so many are dying does speak of the mass slaughter, doesn't it?
It speaks of the fact that Hamas is waging war from inside densely populated areas. Lewis, we didn't pick this battlefield. We didn't even pick this war.
No, but you're choosing the way
Lewis, we don't want this war.
That's the point.
The aid is getting in. The problem is that the UN is struggling to distribute that aid at the pace that Israel is facilitating its entry into Gaza.
Okay, but there's also a lot of aid on the other side of the border, where this was posted by the former humanitarian coordinator for the United Nations, who's now working for the Norwegian group here, and he was saying that is aid that cannot get in. But I want to get to aid.
The amount of aid actually is increasing.
I want to get to aid generally and how much is getting in. But on the fact that the U.S. is now orchestrating airdrops to go into that, is that really the solution that Israel thinks is the way to get out of this, the way to help feed these starving people in Gaza?
Well, there are two questions. One is the question of aid getting into the Gaza Strip, and there is enough capacity at Israel's crossings to get in as much aid as the international community is sending.
Clearly there's not.
No, but then there's a question of how aid is being distributed inside Gaza. And we're talking about airdrops into areas that are difficult to reach because they are active war zones. Because Hamas is still fighting in the northern Gaza Strip and because these are dangerous areas. And we saw what happened just the other day with those horrific scenes of the fourth convoy of the week trying to take aid into northern Gaza and being mobbed by desperate civilians who then got killed in a stampede. So one option is to airdrop aid. And there was a successful pilot this week in cooperation with, I believe, Jordan, Egypt, the UAE, France and the United States to airdrop aid into Gaza. And we're looking into other ways to deliver aid into northern Gaza and make sure, again, it gets to civilians who need it while making sure Hamas cannot steal it.
Isn't there a safer, easier way to do this than just simply airdropping it in? I mean, the reason you saw that chaotic incident is people are rushing these trucks because they're starving. I mean, it's desperation in its fullest extent that you're watching. And we hear from the IDF saying, well, our forces felt that they were endangered, and that's why they fired upon the crowd after firing those warning shots. That's what the IDF maintained.
Well, they said they fired when people began to rush towards the soldiers.
But the people are rushing towards the soldiers because they have food and they're starving. Well, I mean, doesn't that speak to the desperation and that the situation actually is not good and there's not enough aid getting in?
So on the question of Biden suggesting that Israel is losing global support, does that influence the thinking of the Israeli government in any way? I think it's become clear, given what the UN Security Council tried to push forward this weekend that the U.S. blocked, that the world is not okay with the 18,000 plus people that have been reported killed, many of them women and children in Gaza. Does this in any way alter what Israel is trying to accomplish, or at least the way that it approaches its war with Hamas?
Well, first of all, the UN is a strange place, and there's an automatic, as you know, Boris, there's an automatic anti-Israel majority there at the United Nations. And we thank the United States. We're very appreciative of that veto that we had, the America's diplomatic protection. It really is appreciated here in Israel. But as we move forward in this, it's crucial that we win this war. It's crucial that we defeat Hamas. In doing so, in parallel, we have to do everything we can to safeguard Gazan civilians, and we have to do everything we can to make sure they get the aid that they need. But that war needs to be won. For Israel, there is no choice. We have to defeat Hamas.
Yes, clearly something has changed in the narrative here, something fundamental, so that the cries of criticism of the Israeli state is anti-Semitism are ringing increasingly hollow, as is even the fundamental justification for all of what we've seen playing out over the past 10 months, the supposed provocation of October 7th. And I say supposed provocation not because I do not believe people actually died, but because there are many, many, many questions about how those killed on October 7th were actually killed. And we could start our examination of that question from even the earliest reporting that was coming out, even from the official and mainstream establishment media. There was already, within days, significant questions about who knew what when with regards to what happened on October 7th. For example, the Times of Israel had this up just within 2 days of October 7th. Egypt intelligence official says Israel ignored repeated warnings of something big, which notes that Egyptian intelligence officials said that Jerusalem had ignored repeated warnings that the Gaza-based terror group was planning something big, which included an apparent direct notice from Cairo's intelligence minister to the prime minister, Netanyahu. And it goes on to say that in one of the said warnings, Egypt's intelligence minister, General Abbas Kamel, personally called Netanyahu only 10 days before the massive attack that Gazans were likely to do something unusual, a terrible operation, according to the Ynet news site. Unnamed Egyptian officials told the site they were shocked by Netanyahu's indifference to the news and said the premier told the minister the military was submerged in troubles in the West Bank. Of course, for what it's worth, Netanyahu immediately denied receiving any such advance warning, saying in the course of an address to the nation Monday night that the story was fake news, but that was something that only shocked Egyptian officials further. For Palestinians in Gaza, the article goes on, Israel's eyes are never very far away. Surveillance drones buzz constantly in the skies. The highly secured border is awash with security cameras and soldiers on guard. Intelligence agencies work sources and cyber capabilities to draw out information. But Israel's eyes appear to have been closed in the lead up to the surprise onslaught by the Hamas terror group, which broke through Israel's border barriers and sent hundreds of terrorists into Israel to carry out a brazen attack that killed over 700 people and wounded over 2,000. Now, there are many, 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 many points that we can and should interrogate when it comes to the official story of October 7th, but this is not an episode that is dedicated to deconstructing that particular terror myth that has been propagated by the Israeli authorities. However, I think articles like this one at least raise the questions that should start being raised if we start thinking about this. For example, yes, the question of that incredibly, probably the most highly surveilled and secured border on the planet Earth being breached in such a spectacular fashion, with the dastardly terrorist operatives being allowed to move around unhindered for hours after their brazen paragliding breach of the border. Well, some people in positions to know had some very big questions about what took place. For example, this came out late last year. Our warnings on Hamas were ignored, Israel's women border troops say, which notes that, did Israel's security chief brush off warnings from women border surveillance soldiers who had evidence that something was brewing in Gaza ahead of the murderous attacks by Hamas militants on October 7th? That's the explosive accusation coming from several soldiers in Israel's predominantly female border surveillance forces, known as the, I will not attempt to pronounce that, or lookouts in Hebrew. The soldiers are telling the media their superiors did not heed warnings of unusual activity inside Gaza, such as Palestinian guerrillas training with explosives or rehearsing attacks on a replica tank and a mock observation post, etc., etc. Now, this article is framed as if these are explosive accusations that are coming from these irresponsible border guards who have absolutely no reason whatsoever to be making this up. Absolutely no incentive, no reward for coming out within a month of the attack itself to say, hey, we were being completely ignored when we were sounding the alarm and trying to blow the whistle on this. And yet it is still framed as some sort of he said, she said accusations. Who can really know? But for what it's worth, even this story is something of a limited hangout. Yes, they saw the Hamas soldiers training on these mock-up observation posts, etc. But in fact, it's much more direct of an accusation than that by certain people who, again, are in positions to know. And for this, we'll turn to Efrat Fenningson, who people will remember as one of the people, an Israeli journalist who interviewed me last year before the October 7th attacks. She interviewed me about my work. And as it turns out, she had spent time in the Israeli intelligence forces, not just stationed anywhere, but stationed on the Gaza border 25 years ago. She knows what types of surveillance were being deployed on that border 2.5 decades ago, let alone what kind of upgrades in that technology have taken place in the intervening years. And, well, she certainly, for one, was not buying the official story of what happened on October 7th.
When I saw the attacks, my first thought, literally, was, how is this even possible on that border that it could be breached by so many people simultaneously? One would have expected, if an attack had been successful, that the number of people who got through initially would have been small. You know, if 5 people had gotten through out of a military force of 100 and had done some damage, that would certainly be noteworthy and would be considered an embarrassing failure for the IDF and the security services of Israel. But to have hundreds get through and operate barely impeded for, was it a full day almost? This seems like it is not, if somebody submitted it as a script, you would say that is implausible. And so it did lead me to wonder what could possibly explain such a failure. Incompetence seems inadequate to explain it. Now, you're in a position to say more about this because you have manned that border.
Yeah. It's very hard for me to talk about it because it's there are so many friends and family members of friends that are missing and have been taken hostage in this barbaric act, that talking about what I know feels like why is this important now? And at the same time, I know that if we don't talk about this, then we will just let them off the hook once again. Because to me, and I will explain why I think this is a great atrocity. Because to me, this is, it's, I don't know how to say it. It's just the people of Israel have been I don't know if sacrifice is too rough of a word, but we have been sold and
sold out
completely, and no help for hours and hours, and no military involvement, no police, no arms on the ground for hours and hours. This is something that is non-typical and unusual for Israel Defense Forces. Now, I've served in the military forces 25 years ago as I was in the intelligence forces based in the Gaza Strip, as I told you. And I know the security drills. When I served, there was no internet. So I would sit next to the phone in my shift of the fence of the security of the Gaza Strip. And whenever something would move alongside the fence, I would get a phone call from the human observers that are looking at the gate, telling us there is a chain of command that you have to notify when something like this happens. And then straight away, forces come in to look at what is it and take it down.
So what do you mean when something moves by the fence? How small
is it? It can be a pig. It can be a cat moving alongside the fence or touching the fence or trying to cross the fence. An animal, they would identify it. They would see it.
A cat gets scrutiny.
Would trigger. Yeah, it could trigger the fence. Yeah,
and
an animal.
25 years later with...
And 25 years later with internet and with the most sophisticated high-tech weaponry systems... like drones, like there is a special system, I don't know how to call it in English, it's called seeing shooting. That's a literal translation from Hebrew to English, seeing shooting. It's a robot that sits on top of a tower looking at the fence, and whenever something triggers the fence, which has sensors on it, it's supposed to shoot. It's like automatic, right? And there are drones and there are helicopters and there are troopers on the ground. And, you know, there are many things that are supposed to be activated. There are various lines of defense and layers of defense that are supposed to be activated when something like that happens.
Okay. So I just want to make this clear. I mean, it probably is, but you have a system that is sensitive to anything the size of a cat or bigger. That system, since you were manning it, has had 25 years to mature and become more sensitive, to become more discerning. And yet, how many places was that border breached?
15.
15 places?
If not more, yeah. 15. And that is completely ridiculous because normally with one breach of the fence, the whole army is triggered and things start moving immediately.
Now, you can go continue watching that conversation. Of course, I'll put the link in the show notes if you want to hear more about that. But that, of course, was just responding to what was known at that time, just in the literally just days after October 7th took place. But in the intervening time, much, much more information has come along to trouble the establishment Israeli government propaganda narrative about the events of that day. For example, just last month, we had this report from the Jerusalem Post. IDF knew of Hamas's plan to kidnap 250 before October 7th attack, according to a report. It says the IDF had precise information about Hamas's intentions. But, and here's the limited hangout, due to prevailing conceptions in the security establishment and possible negligence by officials, who can say, the warning signs were not acted on. And this report notes that a newly surfaced document has revealed that the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, and intelligence systems had detailed knowledge of Hamas's plan to raid Israel and kidnap 250 people weeks before the October 7th massacre. The document, which was compiled in the Gaza division, outlined Hamas's intention and was known to top Israeli intelligence officials, according to a report by Khan News. The document titled Detailed End-to-End Raid Training was distributed on September 19th, 2023, and described in detail the series of exercises conducted by Hamas's elite units. All right, there's plenty more information along these lines that we could bring up and examine here. As I say, today's exploration is not an exploration of the October 7th false flag in particular, so I will not belabor the point. But if we're bringing up all this material and information about Hamas, well, it might serve us to know a little bit more about Hamas itself. So we might want to look into my reporting on the secret history of Hamas that I wrote a couple of months ago. And of course, there is the question, an open question, of how many Israelis were killed by Israeli security forces on October 7th, because we know that the number is not zero. We know that number is a number. We don't know how significant that number is. So even if we swallow the Hamas story and narrative wholesale, then we still know 100% that Israelis killed Israelis on October 7th as well. And the only question is how many. And again, we do not have to venture out on speculative conspiracy limbs for that information. We can take it straight from the horse's mouth. In this case, Haaretz, which had this article up just earlier this month, confirming what James Evan Pilato was reporting on New World Next Week months and months and months ago. But here it is confirmed. IDF ordered Hannibal directive on October 7th to prevent Hamas taking soldiers captive. And for those of you who don't remember that previous edition of New World Next Week, the Hannibal directive is a procedure that is known in the Israeli army, in which they are given carte blanche to foil kidnapping at any expense, including taking the lives of the kidnapped. To make sure that no hostages are taken, you might as well kill the hostages too. And that was the order that was given on October 7th. They can confirm. A very senior IDF source confirmed to Haaretz that the Hannibal procedure was employed on October 7th, adding that this was not used by the divisional commander, who did give the order. This, said the source, will perhaps be established by post-war investigations, or perhaps covered up by those quote-unquote investigations. But just to give you an example, just to put that in perspective, what that means, they report, for example, a new development occurred at 2 p.m. on October 7th. All the forces were instructed not to exit border communities toward the west, in the direction of the border, with an emphasis on not chasing terrorists. At that point, the border area was under intense fire, directed at anyone in that area, making it a danger zone. So what are the implications of this? Well, the instruction, says the source in Southern Command, was meant to turn the area around the border fence into a killing zone, closing it off toward the west. Kill anything and everything that's moving over there. Of course, this is at 2 p.m., hours and hours and hours later, hours and hours and hours after an effective military response would have actually been meaningful. To prevent what happened rather than to allow it to happen and then to kill everyone involved in order to jack up the murder rates. More explicit examples they cite here. For example, one case in which it was known that civilians were hit, a case that received wide coverage, took place in the house of Pessy Cohen at Kibbutz Be'eri. 14 hostages were held in the house as the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, attacked it, with 13 of them killed. So again, there's just one documentable example that is not a conspiracy theory. We know about that. But don't worry, the post-war investigations will get to the bottom of how many Israelis were killed by Israel, right? Well, I'm not holding my breath for that. But if all of this information that complicates the narrative of October 7th puts you in mind of, well, October 7th is sounding more and more like Israel's 9/11, well, I agree with you. And even in the days afterwards, that's exactly what I was trying to point out, that there are a lot of similarities, because essentially this elaborate tale of these paragliding terrorists going across the most surveilled, heavily defended border on the planet Earth, in a border that so much as a cat moving along would set off all sorts of alarms and cause border security to show up. Well, they just waltzed in and proceeded for hours to do what they did on that day. That's exactly as believable as the story of 19 men with box cutters aided by a man on dialysis in a cave halfway around the world, breaching through the most heavily defended airspace on the planet for over an hour, just flying around, doing their thing, completely unmolested by a single fighter interceptor. You know how stupid that story that we are expected to believe is. Well, this is the Israeli 9/11 equivalent of that story. But having said all of this, again, the point of today's episode is not to deconstruct October 7th, because in a certain way, perhaps all of this distracts us from the real point. What is the real point of this? Not examining the supposed justification for what came afterwards, but pointing out that what came afterwards, even if we were to swallow the story and narrative of October 7th, hook, line, and sinker, is absolutely, on its face, utterly unacceptable, unsupportable, disgusting, a crime against humanity in the truest sense of that phrase. There is no doubt that what we have witnessed over the past nearly 10 months is not a war, it's not a conflict, it is a wholesale slaughter that has been taking place. And there's really no arguing with that fact. My mind boggles at even trying to present the evidence of this slaughter, because there are so many examples of it that have been spread so widely in so many different days and weeks and months that there is no possible way to accurately encapsulate it in a short presentation like this one. You could start, for example, by talking about the documented massacres, like the Flower Massacre, of people trying to get to food aid being mown down by the dozens. Absolutely unthinkable, unsupportable in any other conflict whatsoever that would take place anywhere in the world, except if that happens to take place in occupied Palestine. Or how about Israel continues bombarding Gaza, including places it told Palestinians to evacuate to? Yes, that's right. The Israeli government has no problem telling Palestinians, guys, go over here or else we're going to bomb you. And then when they go over there, bomb them anyway. That is, on its face, the most brazen war crimes I have seen in my lifetime. But here we are. It doesn't end there. Not only the Palestinians, not only the women and children being murdered because human shields, I tell you, so you can slaughter them with abandon, absolutely no limits. A million Gazans for one Israeli life, right? The U.S.-Israeli murder of World Central Kitchen aid workers. Remember that story? Absolutely. Again, one of the most brazen slaughters I have ever seen take place in a war zone against aid workers. And again, this is not, absolutely, this was not a, oops, we accidentally hit some aid workers. Well, these things happen in war zones. These aid workers were targeted, were pursued, were, they had one clearly marked vehicle completely destroyed. The ones who managed to escape from that one into another vehicle were then pursued in the other vehicle until it was destroyed. A slaughter, an absolute murder of aid workers. But that's just the one example that made a lot of news headlines because it was so on its face, brazen and undeniable. But that, of course, is just the tiniest, thinnest edge of the wedge when it comes to this wholesale slaughter of aid workers that's taking place in Gaza right now. Gaza's invisible massacre, aid workers killed in record numbers. And that was, again, from a couple of months ago. But it's not just aid workers. How about Gaza War, most dangerous ever for journalists, says Rights Group, which noted that the first 10 weeks of the Israel-Gaza War has been the deadliest ever recorded for journalists, with the most journalists killed in a single year in one location. And that was just in the first 10 weeks. We're nearly 10 months into this conflict now. It doesn't end there. UN, Israeli authorities responsible for crimes against humanity. Talking about all of the various pieces of evidence along those lines. So, again, my mind boggles. There are so many other incidents, so many things that we could talk about. Again, not, it's not just the Palestinians being murdered. It's not just the aid workers. It's not just the journalists. But it's the Israeli hostages, too. Not just on the day of October 7th through the Hannibal Directive, but afterwards as well. Remember the story about the three Israeli hostages trying their best to surrender, writing SOS on their white flag, coming out, speaking in Hebrew. No, we're hostages. We're hostages. Slaughtered, murdered in cold blood. Remember that? Of course, this does raise some fundamental questions, doesn't it? As I continue to say, my mind boggles at even trying to present this evidence, let alone having to make the case that what we are seeing is a slaughter. But I guess here's the question. So what is the legality of all of this anyway? I mean, all's fair in love and war, right? That's how this all works. Well, no. No, it isn't. And here's an interesting article that I will direct your attention to. Do Palestinians have the right to resist? And what are the limits? Short article. Well, this is indeed a short article that goes through this question, because it does seem like a pretty important one, given what we're talking about right now. given the fact that, okay, human shields, guys, you saw that artist rendering that the IDF put out of the comic book terrorist headquarter layer under the hospital that turned out to be an MRI machine and two guns that were placed there later by Israeli agents. You saw it, guys. So therefore, bomb the whole place to smithereens, kill every man, woman, and child in the area, totally legit. Oh, wait, maybe it isn't legitimate. Maybe, actually, Palestinians do have a right to resist what has been determined to be an illegal occupation. Remember that? We've just talked about it. Not just the ICJ, but many other bodies have come out and ruled time and time again that the Palestinian occupation, the occupation of Palestine by Israel, is illegal. So what is the Palestinians' position here? Do they have a right to resist under international law, whatever that's worth? Well, here they go through this, point by point. Well, of course, the illegal occupation represents an unlawful use of force. As long as the illegal occupation persists, it constitutes, according to international responsibility rules, a contentious, wrongful act, thus preserving the continuous right to self-defense of the occupied state or people. Well, that's just verbiage. Show me the money. How do you know this? Well, is the Israeli occupation legal now? Well, of course, we've just went through that and they have more resources here. No, it is illegal. Time and time again, ruled illegal. So self-defense by Palestinians can only be exercised after assessing the principles of necessity, proportionality, and imminency, which absolutely and truly and, of course, does not legitimate the killing of Israeli children or babies or taking hostages or any of that action whatsoever. And just because you are against the wholesale slaughter of Palestinians does not mean you are for the wholesale slaughter of Israelis, no matter what Israeli government propaganda would have you believe. Of course not. There are limits to self-defense, absolutely, but there is the right to self-defense. So how do we know that? Dozens of resolutions by the UNGA support national liberation movements in their struggle for independence. For example, Resolution 21005 of 1965, talking about the Portuguese colonialism in Guinea-Bissau, but also the Declaration on Friendly Relations, which reflects customary law, recognizes the right to resist against forcible actions that deprive people of their right to self-determination. It is Israel that is required not to suppress resistance, rather than the opposite. Required not to suppress resistance. Required. In 1982, UNGA Resolution 37/43 affirmed the legitimacy of the struggle for independence, territorial integrity, national unity, and liberation from foreign domination and foreign occupation. Furthermore, the additional Protocol 1 of the Geneva Conventions, to which Palestine acceded in 2014, joining over 160 countries, in its Article 1 Subparagraph 4 classifies conflicts in which people are fighting against alien occupation and racist regimes as armed conflicts. Individuals engaged in such fighting, if captured, should be afforded the status of prisoners of war, meaning their fighting is legitimate. If the Geneva Conventions recognize you as an enemy combatant, gives you the status of war and affords you those protections, well, that means it is an actual conflict. Legitimate fighting is happening there. 9, historical evidence. And 10, finally, is worth emphasizing the right to resist and self-defense is subject to the rules of international humanitarian law, including the aspect of the principle of distinction between civilians and combat. So in short, right to resist, including armed resistance, yes. Right to indiscriminately kill or target civilians, no. It's as simple as that. And that applies both ways. Of course, the right to self-defense applies to every human being, and this does not come from any UN resolution or international court ruling or anything of that sort. It comes from our rights as individual human beings, our right to self-defense. However, that right to self-defense is about proportionality, and it certainly does not give you the right to indiscriminately kill or target civilians, whether you are a Palestinian indiscriminately killing or targeting an Israeli, or an Israeli indiscriminately killing and targeting civilians in occupied Palestine. So there is an incredibly important point here, which is that what we are witnessing right now in Gaza is not the legitimate self-defense of the Israeli state against, you saw those dastardly terrorists on October 7th. What is happening is an indiscriminate slaughter of civilians that is happening under the pretense, using the justification of whatever happened on October 7th. In order to take it one step further and to call this out for what it really is, genocide, the G word, we need to look into that word. Because that is a big word that is bandied about a lot. What does that really mean? What is the actual definition of genocide? And does it really apply to what we are witnessing right now in Gaza and the West Bank? Well, let's take a look. Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide. Approved and proposed for signature and ratification or accession by General Assembly Resolution 260A of 9th of December 1948. Entry into force on 12th of January 1951 in accordance with Article 13. So yes, this is the actual legal definition of it in international law. And here we go. In the present convention, genocide means any of the following acts committed with intent to destroy, in whole or in part, a national, ethnical, racial, or religious group as such. A. Killing members of the group. B. Causing serious bodily or mental harm to members of the group. C. Deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part. D. Imposing measures intended to prevent births within the group. And E. Forcibly transferring children of the group to another group. Then you can read about the punishment and the laws surrounding this crime of genocide. But that's the operative definition. So that's what we need to be looking into. Is this part of a plan, a coordinated plan, to destroy, in whole or in part, the national, ethnical, racial, or religious group, i.e. Palestinians? Well, this is not some undecidable question. We have plenty of evidence that there is, in fact, such a coordinated and targeted plan that is being waged right now against the Palestinian people.
Israel's national security advisor Tzachi Hanegbi has spoken to Jordanian Foreign Minister Ayman Safadi in an attempt to extinguish the flames following the uproar over Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich's speech in Paris, in which he declared that there is no such thing as a Palestinian people. Hanegbi's conversation with Safadi came after the Jordanian Ministry of Foreign Affairs announced that it had summoned the Israeli ambassador in Jordan for a reprimand following Smotrich's speech. Smotrich claimed in his remarks that he is the true Palestinian and his family are the true Palestinians since they have lived in Jerusalem for many generations.
הלייק לציוץ של פעיל ימין דודי בן ציון שכתב בטוויטר אחרי הפיגוע הרצחני את הכפר חווארה צריך למחוק היום.
כי אני חושב שאת הכפר חווארה צריך למחוק. אני חושב שמדינת ישראל צריכה לעשות את זה.
זאת אומרת,
חס וחלילה, לא אנשים פרטיים.
אתה שמח שקומץ פורעים הגיעו ועשו פוגרום בחווארה?
אנחנו מטילים מצור מוחלט על העיר עזה. אין חשמל, אין מזון, אין מים, אין דלק. הכל סגור. אנחנו נלחמים בחיות אדם ואנחנו נוהגים בהתאם.
Israeli Minister of Finance, meanwhile, Bezalel Smotrich, says Israelis will live in Gaza. He told Israel's Army Radio, we must encourage the residents of Gaza to emigrate as they live in hardship and poverty. The Israelis want to return to Gaza because it's a beautiful place and they will turn the desert into a prosperous place.
אמרתי לצרוף את עזה, לצרוף, מה זאת אומרת? להיכנס ולקרוא אותם, זאת אומרת, אין פה מחשבה אפילו, אין שיקול דעת. אתה מבין? שחיילים של צהל לא יחשבו לשנייה אחת ויפגעו, בגלל שאנחנו צריכים להיות אומנים.
מה זה אומר לפגוע באוכלוסייה?
אין חפים מפשע, זה בדיוק כשאתה אומר אוכלוסייה, אין אוכלוסייה. יש 2.5 מיליון טרוריסטים, ולכן אין משמעות להקש בגג. עושים הקש בגג כדי שחוף מפשע ייצא. ברגע שבעזה אין חוף מפשע, אז אין טעם להקש בגג, כי כולם טרוריסטים.
לא נותרת אבן על אבן בעזה. עזה הופכת לדרזדן. כן, שריפה מוחלטת. קלו כל הקיצים.
What I think about Gaza, the Arabs of Gaza lost the right to be in Gaza. On the 7th of October. No Arab, I'm speaking about more than 2 million Arabs. Mm-hmm. They will not stay there. We, Jews, will be in Gaza.
That sounds like ethnic cleansing.
Look, I realize that people in the audience who are not inclined to accept the thesis of today's episode are probably not inclined to put much credulous belief in those clips. Oh, that's just a cherry-clipped assembly of fringe weirdos and extremists. You'll find that on all sides, argue anything. Hey, look, I could put together a bunch of clips of Hamas extremists and Palestinians calling for the death of Israelis. So what does that get you? It's a wash. So don't take my word for it or my interpretation. But let's expand the net here and see if other people can also see this pattern that amounts to really the crime of genocide. Let's take a look, for example, at this report on genocide in Gaza, analysis of international law and its application to Israel's military actions since October 7, 2023, which was released in May by the University Network for Human Rights, which, executive summary, let's just cut to the chase. They note, as we just did earlier, the crime of genocide requires that a perpetrator kill, seriously harm, or inflict conditions of life calculated to bring about the destruction of a group in whole or in part with the intent to destroy the group as such. And how that applies to the Palestinians. Well, after reviewing the facts established by independent human rights monitors, journalists, and United Nations agencies, we conclude that Israel's actions in and regarding Gaza since October 7, 2023, violate the Genocide Convention. Specifically, Israel has committed genocidal acts of killing, causing serious harm to, and inflicting conditions of life calculated to bring about the physical destruction of Palestinians in Gaza, a protected group that forms a substantial part of the Palestinian people. Between October 7, 2023 and May 1, 2024, Israel has killed at least 34,568 Palestinians and injured 77,765 other Palestinians in Gaza. These figures, in total, comprise more than 5% of Gaza's population, with over 2% of Gaza's children killed or injured. Approximately 14,500 of the Palestinians killed in Gaza have been children. Israel killed more children in the first 4 months of its assault than in all of the world's conflicts in the past 4 years combined. Israeli forces have killed Palestinians regardless of their protected status under international law, with the current bombardment constituting the deadliest conflict for journalists ever recorded, and the number of UN personnel killed reaching a degree never seen in history. Israel's military operation has destroyed up to 70% of homes in Gaza, and has decimated civilian infrastructure, including hospitals, schools, universities, UN facilities, and cultural and religious heritage sites. A staggering 1.7 million civilians, over 75% of Gaza's population, have been forcibly displaced as a result of Israel's military offensive. Civilians in Gaza face catastrophic levels of hunger and deprivation due to Israel's restriction on and failure to ensure adequate access to basic essentials of life, including food, water, medicine, and fuel. And they do ultimately go on to conclude Israel's genocidal acts have been motivated by the requisite genocidal intent, as evidenced in this report, by the statements of Israeli leaders, the character of the state and its military forces, conduct against and relating to Palestinians in Gaza, and the direct nexus between them. And of course, that does constitute the bulk of this very extensive, very meticulously documented report. So I will put this in the show notes. I think that this would be some interesting reading for people in the audience who still might not quite understand what is being said here. But yes, genocide in Gaza. Now, once again, this seems like an intractable problem. What can we possibly do about this? Oh, I know. Go to the slave suggestion box. Vote harder, guys. But vote for what? I mean, even if you believe in the morality of the democratic system itself, even if you believe in the superstition, the most dangerous superstition of government, even if you believe that this tooth fairy will give you a better set of results than that Santa Claus for delivering Christmas goods, it does not matter at all with regards to this issue. Vote Trump, guys. Vote Harris, guys. Vote RFK, guys. They all are supportive of Israel in their slaughter of the Palestinians, every one of them. So, no, I don't think voting would be a solution, even if you were inclined to think that voting is a solution to anything, which obviously I am not. But no, of course, the solution to this is certainly not going to come through the same political process that has landed us in precisely this spot. So while there are stories that seem hopeful, in a certain sense, for example, this one from last month, IDF Netanyahu's goal of eliminating Hamas is unachievable, the U.S. intelligence community assesses that Israel cannot defeat the militant Palestinian organization, talking about an Israeli military spokesman saying the goal of eradicating Hamas is not achievable, so we have to start thinking about how we're going to end this conflict. In a sense, that is a good story, as is something like this. People might have saw Haaretz, published an op-ed by Ehud Olmert. I accuse Netanyahu of betrayal. Talking about, I accuse the Prime Minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, of taking deliberate action to prolong the war between Israel and the Palestinian murder organizations. Interesting choice of words there. I accuse him of intent to expand the war and initiate a direct all-out military confrontation with Hezbollah in the north. I accuse him of taking deliberate actions meant to cause a widespread flare-up of violence in the West Bank. Accuse him of abandoning the Israeli hostages, etc., etc. As I say, you may have seen this op-ed, and again, it represents something ultimately optimistic, in a sense. And not because, yes, please be cynical of military statements or political statements like these ones, because of course they are embedded within the narrative that only ultimately justifies and excuses the genocide that is taking place. Oh, we can't possibly win this war just by bombing civilians to death, so we're probably going to have to start thinking about wrapping it up sometime. It's not quite the victory that we're looking for here, and neither is a political ploy between Netanyahu and his political opponents within the Israeli government, who are obviously jockeying for control of the Israeli government itself and the power that that affords. Again, that's internal, domestic, political, what have you. But it does point to a deeper conversation that's taking place where it actually matters among the Israeli people, the Palestinian people, people around the world who are, perhaps as I have indicated here, perhaps for the first time, at least the first time in my lifetime, I am seeing a different narrative forming around the slaughter that's taking place right now, which could manifest in something different, potentially. For example, even Haaretz is publishing op-eds even of this sort. Israel's continued denial of the reality of the occupation will be its ruin. Yes, of course, there are still those who continue to deny that Palestine is being occupied, let alone occupied illegally. But the longer that that denial takes place, the longer it will take to come to a reckoning with reality. And at least that is starting to be aired as something that can be said within the Israeli political spectrum. But again, more to the point, Israeli protesters call for Gaza ceasefire deal and early elections. Thousands of Israelis demonstrated on Saturday across several cities demanding a peace deal with Hamas and early parliamentary elections. Again, I take absolutely no solace in the idea of elections and parliamentary democracy being the solution here. But the fact that people are taking to the streets, the fact that people are leading a movement against what is happening right now is the first step towards something resembling a resolution to what is taking place right now. I don't know how to get to peace in the Middle East, but I know it will not come through more politicians claiming to speak for millions or billions of people. They do not. We speak through our actions and what we choose to do. Now, as I say, I think there is a shift in the narrative that's happening here. I think there is at least the possibility for something positive to emerge from this if the people start leading the process rather than the politicians. And to gain more insight on that, to get a broader perspective on that, I turned recently to someone who I know has been covering the ongoing slaughter in Gaza more carefully, more thoroughly, with more documentable evidence than absolutely anyone I have seen in the independent media, at least not in Israel. And that is Ryan Christian of The Last American Vagabond. If you watch the daily wrap-up or listen to it, you know he has been covering this day in and day out for hours at a time, hours and hours every day, several days a week for the last 10 months. An incredible amount of information that he has been covering. He has seen a lot of this. So I turned to him for his perspective on this. What are the prospects for this going forward? Is the narrative changing? And if so, what does that look like? And what does an end of this conflict actually, what could it possibly be? What could it look like? I recently had the chance to ask Ryan Christian about this. Let's appeal to people's humanity. For those out there yet who haven't yet made up their mind and hardened their hearts on this issue to the point where they can't see the other side as human beings, what would you say to, at the very least, question, get people to question what it is they've been told and to start to look at this information for what it is and to reach out to those people who are similarly, maybe on the other side of this issue, but who have not yet given up their humanity? Is there a way forward for human beings to come together to solve this issue rather than the political class?
Yeah, I mean, I honestly think that's the only reason this is happening, in the sense of any change or positive steps we may be seeing. And it's hard to say that with what's going on, but to be clear, one of the main reasons that this was done was to get the attention, to change the conversation, even knowing that there'd be consequences, in the sense that they knew Israel would commit genocide. And this is almost a point that Israel throws out to say, you knew we would do this, it's your fault, which is kind of counterintuitive if you ask me. But, you know, I think that the point is that people have recognized what's going on because of Israel's belligerence. And I think what that ultimately shows me is something that we've always talked about. I think you and I have had this conversation, that I truly believe that most people want good. And that's why these people pretend to be good, pretend to be fighting for freedom and liberty, because they know that's what we largely want. And so we like to pretend that that's what we are, you know, those in the paradigm that want to lie to themselves. They still pretend that we're fighting for freedom, even though it's pretty self-evident. It's not the case. So I think that that's what we're seeing here. This massive push globally, the protests, as much as the right side of the paradigm in this country desperately tried to kind of fold it into the woke mindset. And it wasn't just this country. These protests were happening around the world. And there were right wing, left wing, Holocaust survivors, Jews, Muslim, Christian, like all coming together and protesting what Israel's doing. And they just couldn't bury that under claims of anti-Semitism and lies about attacks. It broke out, and it has utterly destroyed their entire narrative. There is no putting that toothpaste back in the bottle, James. It's not going to go away. People see through it. And day by day, people are asking new questions. I mean, have you ever imagined we would be in this position where conversations about Zionism and its connection to Nazism would ever even be on some level of this conversation? I mean, these are very real conversations that it's easy to prove. Haaretz has covered this conversation. Yet if you talk about it, you're anti-Semitic. It's actually crazy. My point in saying all this is that I am hopeful that people, as much as it's getting darker, you know, the old analogy, right, is clearly they're pushing harder. They're lashing out. But people day by day are seeing more. And it's just disgustingly sad that it has to be Palestinians taking the brunt of that. But these are people that have been standing. I mean, this is one of the most inspiring aspects of this, to see, for example, the guy who rebuilt his home more than once and painted a mural on it, knowing they were going to bomb again, or, you know, doing what they can to stay there and saying in the camera, I'm not leaving, not because Hamas is making me, because this is my home and I will die here. You know, it gives me chills even thinking about that, the resolve, the resilience of people in that place. And so they were willing to take this step, knowing that they would push this because they're desperate for their own self-determination. And I think that that has changed, it's touched people, you know, that they've awakened to this reality. And at the same time, it disgusts them finally seeing what Israel's been doing. And so to appeal to humanity, for those that may not be seeing it, you know, who may be on the fence, you know, first, I think if you actually took the time to look into what's going on, as opposed to just glancing the narratives and going, you know, trying to avoid seeing it, you would understand immediately what's really going on. I've said this many times from the beginning. I said this when there were hundreds of children dead. I'm saying it now when there's however many tens of thousands that have been killed. There is no narrative that makes that okay. There's not some narrative, you know, 10,000 children have been killed. There's not some narrative where they go, oh, okay, that's why that makes sense. It just doesn't have, there's nothing there. It's amazing going back to like a Madeleine Albright and 500,000 children, we think it's worth it. That's not going to happen anymore, I don't think. I think people have broken free from that, I think, because of a lot of this. So my point in saying that is that there is not some kind of narrative where it brushes away the amount of children, the suffering, the women, the elderly. It's there and you can see it if you just care to look. And I think that's why most people are uncomfortably aware about this. And I think if you haven't seen it, all it takes is really trying to step into the conversation. Just take a look at the children starving to death right now. And that is not because of Hamas. That's not because of anything other than the deliberate actions to starve these people. As anybody in the UN and human rights groups, Amnesty, B'Tselem, which is an Israeli group, Human Rights Watch, all of them have told you that. I always find it so fascinating that before this, whether Biden or Trump or left or right, they always used to tell you to look to these groups in most cases, the mainstream. In a situation like this, you look to the UNs and the human rights groups to kind of get a sense of what's going on. And for the first time in my experience, they're all Hamas, apparently. All of them. The UN, Oxfam, UNICEF, every single one of them saying the same thing. Doctors Without Borders, human rights groups. It's amazing. And it has changed the conversation. So I think that it's only a matter of time. My worry is that this will be in some way wrapped right back in and people will fall back asleep. But this is usually what happens, which would be, it was just Netanyahu. Yeah, everybody else is fine. Go back to sleep or put somebody else in power. And I worry. I mean, that's going to happen, quite frankly. I can almost guarantee it. And I think it's important that we just stay vigilant about this and recognize that the same thing will continue unless we make something different happen as the peoples of our countries.
Once again, that is Ryan Christian of The Last American Vagabond, not only covering this story and all of its developments day in and day out, but thinking about that bigger picture and correctly, I think, assessing the situation. Yes, there is a change and people are starting to wake up to what is happening, but they can quickly be put back in the box of political opinion, of the political spectrum, of voting the bums out and getting a new set of bums in that you will then have to vote out again in however many years, in the never-ending steam valve, the children's driving wheel that makes us feel like we're in control. No, guys, you get to decide the future of humanity. All you got to do is just put that piece of paper in the box, pull that lever, push that thing on that screen. Don't worry, the voting machines they'll work this time. Well, obviously, it's easy for people to go back in the bottle and to put the toothpaste back in the tube and squeeze it back in and put it back all together if you want to be put back in that. Isn't it so much easier? Yes, we can solve all our problems just by voting and kicking some bums out. Yeah, it was all Netanyahu, guys. And once he's gone, sunshine, rainbows, and lollipops. No, people have to start waking up to that lie. And in order to do that, we have to call things by their rightful name. It is not a war that is taking place in Gaza right now. It's not a conflict. It's a slaughter. It's a genocide. It's a Holocaust. Contentious words, but words have meanings, and we better start using those words correctly. Now, there's a lot of information that I have presented here today, and so much more information that should be presented. But I will leave you to explore that on your own time. Of course, everything that I have cited today will be in the show notes for today's episode, as usual. So that might be a good starting point for this exploration, but it is not the ending point. And there is much, much more to educate yourself about the bigger question of this ongoing genocide, because it certainly didn't start on October 7th, 2023. Let alone the question of what did happen on October 7th, 2023. But I think that will have to do it for our exploration here today. I am James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, thanking you for your time and attention, and I look forward to talking to you again in the near future.